Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. I've worked on drug policy for two-thirds of my life so far, and that makes it easy for me to take the long view of things. Change takes time. We take two steps forward, then we get knocked back a step. Yet change happens still. The first ballot measure campaign I ever worked on was the Oregon Marijuana Initiative back in 1984. In those days, few people believed legalization would ever happen. But folks here in Oregon sure did. And that indomitable Oregon spirit vitalized the national legalization movement. I could go on. Lord, could I go on. But I've got a guest, and we've only got half an hour. So let's get this show on the proverbial road. Who are you? What do you do?
Well, my name's Anthony Taylor, and I'm the legislative director for Compassionate Oregon, and I do legislative work in the Oregon legislature.
And you've been a friend of mine for more than 40 years now. Oh, ooh, no, 1984. It's just been 40 years. That's right.
And the work I do in the legislature is lobbying the legislators to alter and amend and improve their approach to drug policy on cannabis, and specifically cannabis in healthcare.
And you've been doing this for a while. I remember flying into Oregon back in 85 to work for the Oregon Marijuana Initiative campaign during the 86 election cycle. And it was the day after I flew in, the day after I arrived in the state, I accompanied you down to the state legislature in Salem, as you were OMI's lobbyist even back then. And here you are still doing work at the Oregon legislature. Now, what was it like being the marijuana guy at the state legislature back in the 80s? You know, I imagine it was a little different, you know, back in the 20th century. How has it changed?
Well, let's keep in mind that in the 80s, we had to deal with Nancy Reagan's Just Say No program. After her visit to Oregon in 1984, all the high school drug stores and pharmacies had to change their name and take the word drug out of their name. So they all switched to high school pharmacy. The legislature was intent on implementing RICO laws on drug offenses and intent on confiscating and seizing property along the way as they busted people for growing weed. Those were the days in the 80s. You know, and as time went on, people's attitudes changed a little bit. You know, back in the 90s, then the states, California and Oregon, Washington started adopting medical cannabis programs, and that softened, you know, the impact a little bit. People said, oh yeah, well, we've heard it's good for glaucoma and cancer, so let's do this. And then, you know, we struggled along for another almost 15 years before we took another approach, citizen initiative, and adopted legalization for adult use. And here we are struggling with what we implemented in the early days before anyone really had a grasp on how they were going to approach this through the state agencies. They received a lot of good advice. They took some of it, but, you know, it ended up in a situation where we are now, which is really complicated and complex and not at all user-friendly in most instances, overwhelmed by regulatory structure and an inability to limit licenses. So the marketplace is oversaturated with retail stores and growers. And, you know, we're not quite sure what it's going to look like, say, in 2030. And when you start looking that far out, you also have to look at what the legislation may come out on the federal level. Of course, conversations right now are about rescheduling cannabis into Schedule 3, which would take it out of the most dangerous, but still leave a lot of impediments for the local states to come up to snuff on. You know, you can't change federal policy without having an effect downstream to all the states. So putting it into the Schedule 3 will have some effects. It won't do much to fix banking or the 280E tax conundrum that all the cannabis businesses face, but it's at least a step in the right direction. Unfortunately, It will be the last step we see them take in scheduling of cannabis in our lifetimes.
I mean, oh, who knows? It has changed a lot. The first, as you folks had been had tried the OMI back in 82.
That's correct. That was the first run at it. Then again in 84. And in 84, there was a lot of controversy around qualifying the initiative for the ballot. And at one point, the Secretary of State did qualify it after some rulings from the Oregon Supreme Court when OMI took it to them to discuss discrepancies they'd found in their research. And then subsequently taken off the ballot by the Attorney General. And so getting the si necessary signatures for the 86 ballot was pretty much in the bag before we even started, because most Oregonians were, as the first state to adopt an initiative process to deal with things that the legislature wouldn't, were upset about that, and how that whether it didn't matter what group it was. They had been mistreated by their state government, and they were willing to do what they could to get this on the ballot and let the people, vote on it. And we ended up with about, I don't know, what was it, 32% of the vote?
26,
And then.
but well, it was interesting because back in the 84 cycle, we did sue them to in the Supreme Court over election law violations and just horrendous abuses. And in fact, that was the reason we were down there in Salem on that day, was that they were about to pass some of the election law reforms, voter registration reforms that you had been working on. A lot of, which actually grew out of that 1984 Supreme Court case. I mean, the voters in the state of Oregon owe a lot to OMI and to your good works, following that case that Michael Rose and Alan Silber argued for us at the Oregon Supreme Court.
Yeah, absolutely. And another thing, it's interesting that you were down there with me in 85, because that's also the year that the legislature implemented a statutory deadline for turning in signatures on the petitions, along with the constitutional deadline. So that adopted a program where if you had the necessary signatures to turn in, you could turn them in 6 weeks ahead of the constitutional deadline. The state had to verify them immediately. If you qualified, you were on the ballot. If not, you could go out and you had another 4 or 5 weeks to collect the necessary signatures. You had the percentage of good signatures, so you knew how many you had to collect. And frankly, that's what kept Paul Stanford's ballot measure 80 on the ballot in 2012, because he did not qualify on the first count, went back out and got the needed signatures, and then qualified and received 47% of the vote on a no campaign campaign. So that's how far we've come in the last 40 years.
You do a lot of good work on medical. I'm going to shift gears for a moment because you do a lot of good work on medical cannabis, advocating for patients. And I'm wondering, in these days of broader adult use legalization, people sometimes forget that there are a lot of people still who use cannabis as medicine. What's it like advocating for patients these days? There's a theme in this interview. What's it like advocating for people who use marijuana as medicine in this time of corporate legalization?
It's a tough slog, I'll tell you, because frankly, medical cannabis, air quotes around that, has become nothing more than a brand in the legislature and to most legislators. And it's been hard to keep bandwidth for the medical cannabis patients since we've dropped to about 15,000 registered patients within Oregon's medical marijuana program. But that's not to say that less people are using it as medicinally or as a supplement to their healthcare programs, because it's so now readily available. Those people that never considered using it before now have access to it. They discovered that it helps with their arthritis, so they go in and they buy cannabis. So more people are using it medicinally in Oregon than ever before. And that's the point that we keep trying to make. But still, access to cannabis is only half the equation. The other equation is what happens when a person that uses cannabis on a regular enough basis that they would test positive for THC on any given day, What happens to those Oregonians when they come face to face with the Oregon healthcare sector, the healthcare industrial complex in Oregon? It can be rough. You can't have, typically cannot have open, honest conversations with your family care physician. You will be penalized if you test positive in your work for THC at your workplace or in your educational aspirations or even getting good health care. For a long time in Oregon, it's eased some over the last 4 or 5 years. If you are a medicinal cannabis user using it on a daily basis, you are out of luck in getting a kidney in Oregon or any other anatomical donation for that matter. As I say, it's eased a bit over the last 4 or 5 years, but it's still an issue. And although, we have to get a physician's signature on a form, a state form, to qualify our debilitating condition, to qualify for the program. And most doctors wouldn't sign it. And as you well know and experience yourself, that was the beginning of cannabis clinics or the pot docs, right? Because regular physicians, MDs and DOs weren't allowed to, weren't signing it. And that continues to this day. And that touches on the fact that we have no cannabis slash endocannabinoid system slash potency slash dosage education for our healthcare professionals, even though third-party vendors have that stuff readily available, but the licensing boards won't take the steps to begin requiring this as part of licensure. I mean, you have people now that are our parents' age that are talking, asking their physicians about using, CBD. They don't have a clue. They don't know that high doses of CBD can affect the enzyme in your liver that regulates coagulation in your blood. They don't know this stuff. So they say, "Oh yeah, go get some CBD. The more the better," right? Meanwhile, they're on blood thinners and their numbers are spiking. So the education for everyone, not just the healthcare professionals, but the cannabis users themselves, is really lacking, and the state has really fallen short, in my opinion, on making cannabis use in Oregon a much safer activity, whether you're recreating it with or using it on a regular basis as a supplement to your healthcare or as your first medicine of choice for a debilitating condition, which it often is.
This is my conversation with Anthony Taylor, co-founder and legislative director of Compassionate Oregon. Back with more in a moment. You're listening to Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Welcome back. Let's hear the rest of my conversation with Anthony Taylor, co-founder and legislative director of Compassionate Oregon.
The quality of life issue is really important, and it's going to be very important in the 2025 legislative session as Compassionate Oregon attempts to get the healthcare facilities to permit the use of cannabis during hospice as an alternative to opioids. It's really important, and probably the biggest thing that legislators across the country have to wake up to, that cannabis is one of the most important things we can add to our healthcare toolkit right now. And it will continue to be as we find out more and more. As pharmacology takes over some of the isolation of, individual cannabinoids and discover that, yes, these THC molecules put these cancer cells into apoptosis. And we have to develop that and we have to implement it because why put people through chemo and radiation if this actually works? And it's virtually non-invasive and very little side effects. And we have anecdotal stories of cannabis and cancer cures throughout its history, at least its recent history. And with the discovery of the endocannabinoid system to sit right along there with our circulatory, nervous, and muscular, all those other systems in our body, I mean, it can't be denied. It's going to be part of the reason they reschedule because of its medical value. And that will at least open up a bigger doorway for medical research. Because right now, most of the medical research on cannabis is being done outside the United States. There's some pockets here and there. We've got some NIDA-funded researchers here in Oregon that are working hard at things like, trying to convince the state that the level of THC and the higher it is, the better the weed is, should be addressed. And there should be a certain section in every store where there's low potency THC for those people that need it every day to function in the real world and get up and go to work and watch over their kids and go to school. They don't need the powerful stuff. And there's still a whole lot of things that need to be addressed, especially on the medical side of the equation. Doctors don't know anything about dosage, right? So what are they going to tell you? So then you have to go to a store and rely on a budtender's advice. So it's like the old saying, my God, what have we done? We have one thing for sure destroyed most of the cannabis culture that we grew up with, where you went down the street to the guy, right? And you checked out what he had. And if it had too many stems and seeds, you passed and you went to the next guy. And you for sure sat down and sampled it. Unless you knew the guy and you knew what he was doing and what products he had, you stopped by, you grabbed some, you went on your way. And the way you determined whether or not you really liked it was by its aroma, its fragrance, and its feel, its cure. So now, a lot of times, you go into a store and you get by, as a result of the process, most of the cannabis flower that's on the shelves is 3 months old because it takes that long to get through the process. You got to harvest it, then you got to cure it, then you got to process it, then you have to test it. Then you have to retest it, maybe, and then you have to get it packaged. And by that time, 60 to 90 days have gone by. And so, being able to smoke fresh flower, you're not going to get it in the stores. Which, on the first side of the equation, access to cannabis for patients, it's not as nice a picture as the state thinks it is. It's not their fault. They just don't understand the culture and cannabis as medicine. They look at cannabis as a revenue stream and what they can do to increase it or what they need to do to shore it up if it begins to fail. They don't look at it as a pyramid with the plant as a whole, with medicine and fiber and fuel and clothing and all that sort of stuff. First, they put the revenue generating aspect of it in the middle of the wheel, and everything spokes out from that. But this state, unlike most of the other states that have adopted a medical program and a recreational program, or a recreational program after they had a medical program, they funded their medical programs with the pro revenue from the recreational sales. Oregon has yet to take that step, and I hearken back to the writing of Measure 91, say, why are you leaving the marijuana program out of funding from all this revenue? And then, 5 years down the road or 6 years, whatever it was, we get Measure 110 and it reallocates all that money again and still left out OMMP. So, you would think that we could carve out $8 million of biennium to take this from a fee-based program to a budgeted program. Which is the same thing they did with the six programs that the OHA was funding from the revenue generated from fees, grower and patient fees, back in the heyday of OMMP when they had 80,000 patients and 40,000 growers. So I think it's time for them to return the favor. So I don't know what things are going to look like in 2030, but I will tell you, I will be working very hard, as will the rest of the people in Compassionate Oregon, to make sure that we get an Oregon version of California's Ryan laws, which allows the facilities to permit the use of cannabis in hospice. And we'll be working very hard. We've got bipartisan support on it, and we're going to work an educational piece into it as well. And I think I'm positive we'll get a hearing on it, hopefully a work session, and get it out of committee. So that's what I'll be working on. And if anybody wants to help, they can certainly reach out to us at compassionateoregon.org. We're going to start a sign-up sheet on that. And so if anybody is interested in helping, if they have stories of having to deal with a dying family member or friend, all opioided out, morphined out, so they spend their last week or two just, kind of comatose, and you want to talk to them, right? You can't. I had this experience with my mom. So there's a lot of work to be done. If you want to help, give us a holler.
In fact, that was my next question. What you and Compassionate Oregon have planned for the near term?
Well, there's another, Oregon has two sessions, a 180-day session and a 35-day session. In a 180-day session, well, in both sessions, there's typically an omnibus cannabis bill. In the 180-day session, it's often quite a lot larger than in the 35-day session, as you can imagine, because there's more time to sort through stuff. It doesn't mean that something's going to get through, but you do have the time. If your argument is, well grounded, you have lots of support, you have the time to get it to the governor's desk. And that's what we're hoping for here.
And then 25 is one of the, and it's the odd numbered years where the which is the long session, just to make sure people are clear. Right on.
That's correct. And back in 85, we had a 180-day session, and then it was a year and a half before we had another one. So, we finally adopted two sessions. But anyway, there is some talk of an omnibus bill for the 2025 session that will contain a number of items from all the players. From OLCC and OHA down to the trade organizations and Compassionate Oregon. There's going to be something in there for everybody. It's not necessarily non-controversial items, but what we'll get down to is, all right, if I can get this, I can swallow hard on this one, right? And then that bill goes. Hopefully it doesn't get loaded up with stuff that requires it to go to Ways and Means, but sometimes when you make a policy change, the agency goes, well, I need a couple more FTEs for that, and so it gets kicked into Ways and Means, and they go and plead their case, I need six more FTEs. Ways and Means goes, all right, let's move this bill. Sometimes you're not that lucky. But there are some changes that the Oregon Cannabis Commission, which in the interest of all transparency, I serve at the governor's pleasure as its current chair and hold its OMMP patient seat on the commission. There are some statutory changes that we've been advocating for some time that we hope to get into a bill like that if it comes to fruition. And there are some other things that Compassionate Oregon would like to see change. For instance, there's a provision where an OMMP patient or their caregiver can take a certain amount of cannabis into an OLCC processor and have it processed into an oil or a tincture or a concentrate, an extract rather, and get it back. But it does not allow the grower who has access to the product, the plant material for processing, it doesn't allow them to take product to the processor and then give it out to the patient or their caregiver. So that's one small change we would like to see. But it just depends, You never know what's going to happen in a session. And I think with 10 of the Republican senators no longer being allowed to come back because they walked out under a constitutional ban against that sort of thing, or consequences for that sort of thing. I don't think we'll see him walking out again anytime soon. So, and that's what jammed up 2021 and 2020, not 2022, but 2021 for sure. They were gone for 6 weeks. And that means everything that was in Ways and Means, or anything that needs, that gets out of the House and is on its way to the Senate without going to Ways and Means, just queues up. And then if, as they did, they come back in the last 7 to 10 days, leadership says, okay, here's our priority bills. Everything else is sidelined and dies in committee. And that's what happened in 2021. And that's, you know, so at that point, our new governor and her administration got a number of their bills through, and some of the other, you know, leadership high priorities got through as well. So here we are getting ready for 2025.
If people were thinking, I want to think about the 2025 legislature, how soon should they be working on stuff for that session?
Well, for the most part, you're already too late for the budget. And so, what the legislature does is, in the interim, it has legislative days. And so, our first legislative days, I don't have my current calendar in front of me, but it's this month. And so, they start having informational hearings on stuff that either needs adjusted or fixed from previous sessions, something that got overlooked, or new stuff coming forward. Right. So now they, in the 20, this last session, they passed a lot of stuff about houseless people and things like that. Now they'll come back in, and over the legislative interim, they'll have, well, in this one, I think they have three legislative days. They have them every other month until session starts. And as we close in on the end of the year, then deadlines start happening for getting stuff into legislative council, getting it back from legislative council. And if everything goes right, it's ready for pre-session filing, which means it's introduced into the legislature in the first couple of 3 days of session and gets assigned committee and starts working its way through.
That was my conversation with Anthony Taylor, co-founder and legislative director of Compassionate Oregon. And for now, that's it. You've been listening to Free Culture Radio. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Many thanks to everyone out there fighting for civil rights, human rights, and social justice. And thanks especially to you, dear listener, for your support. You make it all worth it, and you make it all possible. Free Culture Radio is a volunteer production for Community Radio, syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Free Culture Radio is available as a podcast or direct download. Links are at the website kboo.fm/freeculture. Theme music for Free Culture Radio is composed and performed by Tom Nickel and Four Dimensional Nightmare and is used with permission of the artist. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!